Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Dementia can alter someone's personality and change how they interact with the world. But sometimes it can also lead to moments of profound connection. Jenny McPhee writes about one of those moments in her piece, Refreshing a Mother's Memory with Love and Stories. It's read by Zoe Saldana. She's starred in Avatar and Guardians of the Galaxy, and you can see her in April in Missing Link. Zoe's also the founder of BSay, a new media platform aiming to represent communities that have been left out of mainstream conversations.
My mother is slowly losing her mind. This fact, as well as all the tragic repercussions along the way, takes up a large chunk of my chats with my four sisters, and with many of my friends who are going through similar issues with their parents. Recently, my mother's geriatric specialist told me there was a significant rise in dementia in those 60 and older. My mother is 81, particularly among women, and no one really knows why. I later joked to one of my sisters that with women having to endure so much injustice throughout their lives, it was perhaps a relief to forget it all. But that's just me being cynical. This story is not cynical. I have a large family, and at Thanksgiving, we were 35 sitting around several tables in my mother's dining room, and that didn't even include us all. My mother once flourished in a crowd, playing the perfect hostess, making every guest feel as if his or her presence was crucial. Nowadays, any gathering beyond her five daughters flusters her, and she often retreats to her bedroom. During the Thanksgiving celebration, she pulled me aside and said with panic, "Jenny, who are all these people, and what are they doing in my house? I feel so strange to be here with all these people I don't know." I reassured her that I felt the same way. In truth, I was relieved that she had remembered my name and knew she was in her own house. I live in dread of a day when she won't. We returned to the party, and I, like a politician's aide, did what I have become good at, giving her subtle reminders of whom she is talking to, where she is, what day, month, year it is, etc. I also indulged in impatient snaps at her, relying on the high probability that she won't remember them. My mother, for her part, is brilliant at faking it. After a lifetime of faking it in all sorts of ways as a mode of resilience, she is still an expert, compensating for her memory loss with skill and grace. The fact that my 85-year-old father and his 92-year-old brother, their minds razor sharp, were at the Thanksgiving table surrounded by their present wives and their former wives spoke volumes to the expertise women have developed in accommodating men, and indeed, patriarchy. Early on, my mother was a traditional stay-at-home mom, sewing her daughter's clothes and overseeing all things domestic, though she harbored a secret desire to be a writer. Like so many women of her generation, instead of pursuing her dream, she married it. Though my father was working at a shipping company then, his literary ambitions were paramount, and he went on to become a professional writer. After my parents separated in 1969, I was 7, my mother began to build a robust business as a portrait and wedding photographer. She recently told me that although she would never have chosen to get divorced, she was ultimately glad because otherwise she might never have been forced to discover what she was capable of. Following her divorce, she became active in the local chapter of the National Organization for Women, was a co-founder of a writers' collective dedicated to analyzing gender roles in children's media, and was a co-publisher of two seminal books on sex stereotyping in children's books and primetime TV. During my childhood, she was the breadwinner, the working mom, her second husband, a stay-at-home dad, who brought five children of his own to the menage. At the time, the domestic arrangement was so unusual that People magazine ran a feature on our family. With my stepfather, she had a fifth daughter, Joan, 11 years my junior. When we were growing up, our mother radiated ambition, possibility, and strength. But above all, she radiated love for us, ultimately pushing us out into the world to shine on our own. And now, my four sisters and I are terrified of a time when our mother won't recognize us. We know that day is coming. 3 days after Thanksgiving, it arrived from my sister Joan. My mother had gone with Joan to have dinner with her in-laws in Brooklyn. They were sitting next to each other at the table surrounded by others when my mother turned to Joan and said, "So, remind me, how did we meet?" Taken aback, Joan replied, "Mom, you gave birth to me." "Well then," she said hesitantly, "why didn't I raise you?" "You did, Mom." Overwhelmed, Joan excused herself, saying, "Let me get you some water." Perhaps Joan hoped Mom's lapse was because of too much wine, not enough water. Often, we sisters console ourselves with the thought about our mother that when the circumstances are right, no alcohol, adequate hydration, a lot of sleep, familiar setting, she does well. Her memory nearly intact. During the Thanksgiving holiday, Joan reasoned, Mom had become overtired from having too much family all at once and for too many days. Joan rose from the table and went into the kitchen crying. Mom followed. Joan, not wanting Mom to see how upset she was, moved to a bedroom. Mom followed. "Don't cry, please," Mom urged her when they were alone. "Are you crying because you think I don't love you?" "No," Joan said. "I know you love me." "Are you crying for me?" Mom asked. Joan said nothing. Mom took Joan's hand and held it tightly. "This is me getting old," she said. "It is neither easy nor pleasant, but if I can get through this, so can you. Please know that I love you. Embrace yourself. Because this is who I am now." Joan sobbed, her hand still in our mother's. "It's not that I don't love you," Mom said. "I love you absolutely. It's just that you have slipped from my mind. These things, they happen. And this thing will happen again and again. But I love you. I love you so much." Joan's tears were by now a torrent. She felt awful for making our mother worry, for making her feel ashamed of her failing mind. "I know you love me, Mom," she said. "Honey," our mother said, "I don't know your name right now, but you must trust that I will always know exactly who you are. So do this for me. Tell me everything. I want to know every last detail. Where you were born, where you went to high school and college, what you do for a living, if you are married, do you have children? Come back to the table and sit down next to me and tell me all of it." Since Joan told me this story, her devastation is also mine. But because it did not happen to me directly, my looming question is like a survivor's. Why Joan? Why not me? My sisters and I are so close that I draw great strength from them on an almost daily basis. This gift of unity I attribute to my mother. So why Joan? There are rational explanations, like the fact that Joan lives in Los Angeles, or that, in memory terms, she was the last one in and therefore the first to go. But none of those work for me. Mom has always had a special love for Joan. Not greater, just different. Perhaps that is because she's the youngest, unique in her combination of parents and, as such, in a sense, an only child, though she has 9 siblings. Perhaps it's because she was and is a bridge between the 2 families, or because as a child she was very serious and always a tad sickly, or because Joan's father, her primary caretaker, died while she was still in college. Mom has been profoundly protective of us all, but a little more so of Joan. That Mom managed to muster a magical, mystical self for Joan in that very difficult moment for both of them. That she could speak above and beyond in spite of her memory. That she was able to dig deep and find her brightness. I attribute to her particular love for Joan. That evening in Brooklyn, Joan did as Mom asked and recounted her life story. Our mother could have forgotten any of us, and one day she surely will. But her lucidity, amid terrible confusion driven by powerful love, has given us a way forward. She has affirmed for us the extraordinary power of a mother's love. As if that love were a force, like gravity, governing who we are and how we behave as human beings during our orbit on Earth.
That's Zoe Saldana, reading Jenny McPhee's piece, Refreshing a Mother's Memory with Love and Stories. We'll catch up with Jenny after the break. Jenny McPhee's essay was first published in 2017. Since then, her mother's dementia has progressed further, and she doesn't recognize Jenny anymore. And her mother has also lost her sense of the passage of time.
Most of the time, she thinks she's about 18. But then she'll be 35 the next minute. She's very rarely 82. So it all shifts, and you kind of, as her interlocutor, you know, are just trying to keep up, like, where are you now? It's also spatial, so she doesn't recognize that she's in her own home. She often thinks she's in her childhood home. So what is the brain doing there? It's just going all over the place, right, to memories or stories or thought. Who knows what it is, but it has very little what we call coherence. And I try and just be with her in it.
There have been other changes, too, and in some ways, an unexpected silver lining.
Okay, I'm going to be brutally honest. She's a much nicer person. She was always lovely, and everybody adored her. But she had a side to her that had an edge, and she could be very manipulative. She cannot be manipulative now at all. So she's just lovely. And I feel really lucky because I know with dementia that it can go many different ways. But she went soft. She went just very soft and caring. And I, every time I walk into her house in New Jersey, she comes up to me and she just throws her arms around me and says, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you." And she has no idea who I am. But she knows something that gives her that impulse to do that with me. And it makes me feel like, you know, the most beautiful, important, wonderful person on Earth.
And Jenny still thinks about the moment she wrote about in her piece.
So this experience is heartbreaking from beginning to end. But Mom, in this experience with Joan that I then wrote about, kind of showed us how to be with her. I feel like she really just wants us to be present with her in the moment. And it is an incredible gift. At the same time as it being really, really difficult, it's also an alternate way of being in our world, and I'm sort of grateful for that experience.
Jenny McPhee. She's the author of the novels The Center of Things, No Ordinary Matter, and A Man of No Moon. She works and teaches at NYU and Princeton and lives in New York City with her family. Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. He says that over the years, many people have written in with stories about dementia and Alzheimer's, and he's asked himself why it's such a compelling subject.
I wonder if it's not that, you know, for writers in particular, but for everyone, we are made up of stories and memories. Like, that is who we are and what defines us. And what I thought Jenny did so artfully in her essay was illustrate the poignancy of that, but then turn to, you know, how do we cope with that? And in this case, you cope with it by trying to fill in those memories again and try to, like, refill her life with memories and touchstones, and, like, desperately, as the bucket is draining out memories and facts and relationships, they're sort of desperately trying to pour it back in. Because that's what they need, you know, that's what both people need, but the kids more than the mother, to feel like, who am I without this relationship? And what is this relationship if not for the stories that make it up?
And here's Zoe Saldana.
I chose this essay because I am one of three sisters, and I guess I'm very much in love with my mother, and my sisters are as well. And now that we're in our early 40s and my mom is in her 60s, you start to wonder, you know, that time will come one day when you will probably have to take care of your mom, and your mom may not know who you are. And I wonder, how will I react to that? What will that feel like? It's dread, you know, you dread it. But I think that accepting it as much as you can and living in the present really helps. So this essay was very healing and kind of like a prep for me for a very distant future, hopefully, for us.
Thanks again to Zoe for reading this week's piece. She's an actor, mother, activist, and entrepreneur, and her upcoming movie is Missing Link.
Hey everyone, this is Modern Love producer Caitlin O'Keefe, and before we get to the credits today, there's a little something we've got to do. I'm sitting in the studio with Meghna and sound designer Matt Reed and former Modern Love producer Amory Sievertson, and we're here because we've got to say goodbye to our incredible colleague Jessica Alpert. Jessica has been on the show since its beginning in the fall of 2015, and she has been instrumental in creating the show and making it everything that it is. She's a force of nature. She's somebody who's just able to see the world in a certain way and then will that into being. She's been a mentor and a friend, and today is her last day, and we are absolutely heartbroken to say goodbye to her.
I've been fending off my ugly cry.
Too.
This is a safe space, Meg. Let it out.
Okay, somebody else needs to talk because I'm too sad.
Go, Amory.
Okay. Well, this is Amory. I worked on the show with Jessica for 2+ years, I think. And, you know, the idea was always to have actors come in and read these beautiful essays. But I think Jessica was really the force behind, we are going to get A-list talent.
Yeah,
just you wait. And, you know, I was booking people with her, and I kind of thought, well, if she says we're going to do it, we're going to do it somehow. And I will never forget, it was in the fall of 2015, so, you know, several months before the show had launched. We're just sitting next to each other, sending out our booking emails, and all of a sudden, Jessica lets out one of her classic next to me, and I said, what? And she said, I got a response from a really big name. And I just had this feeling like, that's it. We can do this. We can do this. And it was because of Jess, because of her belief that we could, but also just that classic persistence that, you know, makes her the producer she is and the person she is and the woman that she is. So I just feel tremendously lucky to have gotten to work with her and learn from her for all these years.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I don't know how to follow those.
I don't. Okay, I love you, Jessica.
Okay, so I have worked with Jessica Alpert for 8 years. And do you know how you, everybody does this, right? You just dream of all of the things that you wish for in your perfect supervisor. She's that.
Yeah.
Right?
She really is.
I mean, she's so smart, really aims for, like, excellence in everything that she does. And she's so nice and so kind and so strong and so tough.
And so generous.
And so generous and so funny. And she's the mom of twins, so, like, there's that, too. She's a miracle.
Yeah, she is. And she and our other partner in crime, our former partner in crime, John Parati, are off to form a company together that, I mean, like, could you think of more of a power duo than the two of them?
Yeah, they're going to take over podcasting.
Yeah, they are. And Matt, John has been a friend of yours for a long time and was, you know, a mentor for you as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about him and about Jessica?
Yeah, so I came into the show about 2 years ago and I was pretty green to it. And Jess and John were two huge just guiding lights for me. Last week I didn't get to say anything about John, but John showed me the ropes. And my best hope is that I can continue what he set up when he started. Here's to the goal of trying to keep up the same quality with, you know, as hard as that's going to be.
And here's to them.
So excited about what they're going
to
do.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
If anyone is out there listening thinking, I don't know these people, I just like your podcast, why should I care about these people? I just want you to know that how you function in a team matters. And how you celebrate the work of the people around you that make that work possible and make that better matters. And in many cases and on many projects like Modern Love, it makes all the difference in the world. And we're glad that you listen, and we hope that what we make matters to you.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert and Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. See you next week.